That's the way Mount Palomar is, the 200-inch Mount Palomar, which I visited a couple of years ago. An exciting thing to look at. Over to you, Mel. K2RIW.
Thank you. Yeah, Keck. I remember that. Couldn't think of the word. All right, 6, 10 o'clock, so we better go on. And very interesting. I know we could do most likely a whole evening just on astronomy, but I thought for a change we would just touch on really amateur radio and astronomy, I think, sort of mirror each other. Use a little colloquial wording there, that they do mirror each other in some extent. So let's continue, and then we'll maybe get back to this in some other day, because we would like to hear the space report. Over.
One more quick comment. Please.
Go ahead, John.
Mel, as Dick says, the best recommendation you can give these young students to join the club and go to the planetarium. You'll meet so many people involved. It's just like a ham fest. And they will be able to get very good information, and I bet you they will locate something like a used need for a reasonable price that they can start out to make a discerned effort, and they'll have a lot of fun. And even if they have to use 35-millimeter film and an old focal plane camera or something, because you don't need much, you can do it with a cigar box. They're going to have a lot of fun. Great. I love to hear it.
John, let me find out from you. I believe you live on Staten Island. I'll bet you there's a real nice astronomy club on Staten Island. Is that true?
Yes, there is. We have a small planetarium in Wagner College, and there's a nice group of students that meet there, and it is pretty nice to see. But the planetarium in New York would not be the place to go, because that's mostly tourists. But the local colleges out where you live, and you've got a lot of bright colleges out there, they're going to get so much information, you're not going to believe it.
Yeah, from my point of view, a true ham radio operator is a kind of a scientist. And whether the scientist decides to dwell in radio frequencies or optical frequencies is one of the choices. Astronomy as a club is one of the purest science, as a hobby, is one of the purest sciences there is. It has some extremely deep questions about where did the universe come from? How did it all get here? Are we alone in it? And NASA is doing some extremely good work, which you're going to be hearing about in a few minutes. We got one guy who has been waiting patiently. I hope John is still there. WA2 Victor Delta Hotel. We signed in originally. Go right ahead, John. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, fine. This is good evening to the net, thanks for the opportunity. My question and a comment I have. First of all, my comment has to do with the classifications A2A of MCW and keyed MCW. I remember back in the 70s and 80s when I had my old RBA-5 receiver that tuned low frequency. I remember on 500 kilohertz I would hear MCW with carrier keyed on and off. And I remember all of the non-directional beacons, they were just straight MCW. So that's just as a comment. Let me drop. My question, though, has to do with measuring of Z0, the characteristic impedance, by looking at the launched voltage. And as an example, say we have a voltage source, a step voltage source of 10 volts, say in series with 50 ohms, and then we have a length of transmission line of some unknown Z0, let's say 20 feet, and we look at the voltage that's launched just as the step goes up. Looking at it from voltage division point of view, can't you determine the Z0? Like, for example, if the Z0 of the line is 50 ohms, you're going to get 5 volts launched. If it's 75 ohms, you're going to get 6 volts launched, because it's Z0 over 50 plus Z0 times the 10 is going to give you the V initial. Let me drop it. So my question, Dick, really is, I don't think that's incorrect, but I guess my question is, what kind of losses are going to affect it if you're just looking at that initial launch voltage rather than anything that's coming back as a reflection? back to net.
You've got a lot of the information already, John. What you're describing is the exact operation of a time-domain reflectometer. A time-domain reflectometer puts out a given voltage, 1 volt or 10 volts. It has a very carefully constructed series resistor with that voltage generator, that ideal voltage generator, the step voltage generator. And so if you make that series resistor a pure 50-ohm resistor across a very large frequency range, and then you apply it to an unknown cable, you're now discovering why insertion law of the characteristic impedance of a cable is quite often called surge impedance. That really means you're putting in a surge from a known characteristic impedance signal generator and measuring how much loading your unknown piece of cable creates. And you're exactly right. A 50 ohm cable will give you exactly half voltage across the cable. There's a catch. Let me drop. If you wanted, if you only had 1 foot of the cable, which means that, and assume the cable was a near air type cable, so it's got a velocity factor of almost unity, the signal, that the rise time of your 10 volt signal generator through its 50 ohm resistor feeding that cable would, without a doubt, would get exactly 5 volts. That 5 volt signal would propagate down the cable, which is 1 foot long. It would take 1 nanosecond to do that. It would hit the open circuit at the end and reflect back in 2 nanoseconds. And in 2 nanoseconds, the cable would become an open circuit. Once that pulse goes down and comes back, the net result will be an open circuit, and the full 10 volts will appear across the cable from then on. And there will be no further reflections. So unless your oscilloscope, unless the rise time of your pulse generator was much, much less than a nanosecond, and much, and unless your oscilloscope looking at that voltage was much, much faster in rise time than a nanosecond, you can see how measuring a very short piece of cable would be very difficult. So you've got exactly the right technique, and if the piece of cable you've got is long enough, it'll do the job beautifully. When it comes to the insertion loss of the cable, let me drop. The fancy thing that very few people remember about any kind of transmission line is you essentially, with rare exception, cannot make loss in a zero length. Yes, you can carefully design a pie-shaped resistor, and you can make a termination that has very, very little length, act like 50 ohms across a lot of frequency. But there you're intentionally putting in highly resistive components. When you and I are making a transmission line, we're going to use some good copper or aluminum, but most likely copper, and some good dielectric materials that have low loss. And the only way you get loss out of cable is through its length. Your cable may have 3 decibels per 100 foot. Well, that means it's only got 0.03 decibels per foot. So unless the cable has some real length, for the most part, loss doesn't count. Now, there's a couple of minor exceptions to this. When you get into the nitty-gritty of the skin depth into the copper of the cable, which gives you, at your particular frequency, a little bit of a auxiliary signal at some other phase shift, if you try to resolve whether or not your particular piece of cable is 50.0 ohms or 50.4 ohms, then you're getting into these secondary effects. But for the most part, you and I care about, is that a 50-ohm cable or a 75-ohm cable? And the technique that you just described would do a beautiful job as long as your rise time and scope speed are fast enough for the length of cable you're testing. Because once that signal reflects from the end of the cable, it gives you a brand new impedance, quite often a nearly purely open circuit. Over to you, John. W2VDH, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, fine business. Yeah, of course, what I would only do this if I had like 20 or 30 feet. So the reflection would be, 40 to 60 nanoseconds. Round trip delay would be 40 to 60 nanoseconds. So I would have some time on my cheap scope to actually see what the initial outgoing voltage is. Because I wanted to try this with twisted pair. I wanted to try it with a 30 gauge a twisted pair, just to see what kind of impedance I'd get from that. Oh, incidentally, also, I remember reading that optical lens coatings are really
quarter wave transformers in the middle of the optical band. Back to you, Dick.
I think they're half wave. Let me think about that. No, you're right. It is quarter wave. Because the glass is one impedance, the air is another impedance, and you're trying to make an intermediate impedance between the two. And real good coatings on lenses is not one single coating. It's a whole sandwich of very, very thin coatings where each individual coating has got just the right refractive index so that you get the equivalent of a quarter wave impedance matching transformer, which is more broadband. And they're using something like a binomial taper of the individual refractive indices of the individual coatings. So if you're only using one particular kind of material, yes, you would possibly choose it to be a quarter wavelength thick at the center of the optical band, which would be 550 nanometers green. But you still would be doing a pretty poor job of matching red, which is at the low end, and blue, which is at the high end, frequency-wise. Although all the optical people think in wavelength, so the low end to them is blue in wavelength, and the high end is red in wavelength. 400 to 700 nanometers approximately is the response of a human eye. And by the way, depending on the red laser pointer you buy, whether you buy one at, let me think now, 670 nanometers versus 635 nanometers. You pay the extra money and buy one at 635 nanometers, the exact same 5 milliwatt laser will look 10 times brighter because the eye has got a very sharp filter that's falling off very rapidly between 635 and 670 nanometers. One is a much deeper red than the other. The 670 is a very deep red, and the eye is much, much less sensitive there. Nowadays, the 550 nanometer green laser pointers are a lot more fun, and they're getting very inexpensive. And
repeater, timeout, cancel.
One of those gives you such a bright beam that at nighttime, with reasonable amount of moisture in the air, you can have a crowd of optical astronomy type people in a field, and you point at a particular star with your green laser pointer, and everybody in the crowd sees the exact star that you're pointing at because they see the beam going through the moisture molecules that are in the air. Unless it's a super dry night, that works very well. Okay, so we've learned about surge impedance of a cable, and I think I've gone through the list of everyone who signed in. Did I skip anybody of the original people who signed in? If so, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW and TechNet.
WPB. Had a question.
K2KIF. Yes.
WGB. Let's see now. That's John. Did I skip over you on when it comes to your original question, John? Go ahead.
Yes, sir, Dick. I was to come after Mel.
Boy, sorry about that. Go ahead, John.
No, I don't mind. I really enjoy this. I'm here for the night. Dick, I have a quick question for you. If I understood properly, when you and Mel were discussing a vertical antenna, the ground notwithstanding, the terrain notwithstanding, did I understand correctly that the vertical antenna does have perturbations in its radiation pattern?
Okay. A vertical antenna, and maybe you're talking about a vertical ground plane type, quarter wave or half wave. Maybe the ground plane is suspended above the earth or connected to the earth. And you're asking, is there an azimuthal pattern? If it's in the middle of a wide open field, no other products around it, no other objects around it, I think the azimuthal pattern is equal in all directions. Maybe I misunderstood your question. Over to you, John.
No, you're right. You could think of it, I guess, as an isotropic antenna. I was just wondering if rotating the antenna would reveal any distortions in that donut pattern at all. Are there any perturbations at all?
Now, you said donut pattern. I guess you're right to a degree. If I had a station master-like antenna, which happened to be only a quarter wavelength long or a half wavelength long, and I mounted it at the top of the tower on a long mast, would that pattern be a donut in space? And I think it would be very close to a donut in space. Although the bottom half of the donut would have a slightly different pattern than the top half because of the ground plane radials. And if you rotated that antenna, put it on a rotating device, I think you would see very little change as it rotated. Now, there's various ways that you could feed it by way of a gamma rod or whatever that could give it some slight directional patterns. But if you're feeding it in a conventional manner from the center in the bottom, I think that should have essentially a uniform pattern in azimuth. If you plotted that antenna in azimuth, it would be a nearly pure circle as I see it. Over to you, John.
Okay, Dick, that's good enough. That answers my question. Thank you for taking it. Back to you.
And by the way, you now mount that antenna on the side of a tower, and some other things happen. Good common sense would lead you to believe that there should be a deep null in the pattern in the direction of the tower. In general, that is not true. As long as the tower is not a resonant length at the frequency you're operating at, you'd be amazed how transparent that tower is in many cases. Choose the right distance from the tower that you mount the antenna off the side of the tower, and it's not a 30-foot wide tower, a 30-foot triangle type tower. It's your typical Rhone 25 or Rhone 55 tower, either 12 inches or 18 inches on the side, in the direction of the tower. The signal will be, let me pick a number, 1.5 dB weaker. So the tower is giving you a little bit of shadowing, but you choose the right distance, and the amount of shadowing is quite minor as long as the tower is not resonant. If the tower is a resonant length and it starts acting like a reflector, now you can get any front-to-back ratio you're willing to tune. So a dipole or reflector of a Yagi, or the directors of a Yagi, their effective capture area, and that's not the right word, radar cross-section, changes radically as you change the tuned length. All kinds of crazy things happen. All right, now, I think John, there's another John, KT2KIF. Did we get to that John? Maybe not. KT2KIF, John, if you're still there? K2RIW on the TechNet?
Yes, I am, Dick. K2KIF. I have a friend named Anthony who's not a ham, who is interested in ham, and I was explaining to Anthony about radio. And he also has an interest in telescopes, by the way, so that's really cool that you guys covered that this evening. Hopefully it'll be on that website that you referenced to earlier. But the question now is, how is an audio signal placed on a carrier in a radio transmission? Could you elaborate on that, Dick?
Yes, I can. One of the fun things you can do is to string a long piece of wire around the perimeter of your living room, near the ceiling. And maybe you make it a couple of turns, just in the upper corner of the living room, around the four corners. Connect that to a hi-fi radio that has a reasonable number of watts of output. Construct the right kind of a coil as a receiving coil in the headset that you're wearing, and take that coil of wire and bring it into the earphones. You can transmit audio in a wireless manner from your living room into your earphones. People have done that, and it works reasonably well. Maybe you need a little bit of a preamplifier in order to get enough volume into the earphones. So when you build a coil of wire that big, which is creating a strong magnetic field, and you're in that magnetic field with your fancy magnetic sensing headset, you can get audio. You'll soon recognize as you start walking away from that living room and go into the backyard, the signal falls off real fast. It doesn't fall off by square law, it falls off by cube law. Range to the third power is how fast the signal will decrease. The bottom line is to transmit audio directly into space and to receive it in a wireless manner is extremely difficult, and you don't get very much range out of it. What Marconi and Hertz and, I can't think of all the guys, Tesla and all these other guys discovered. Let me drop. What they discovered with that experiment that I just described to you that you could do in your living room, as you get further and further away from that coil of wire, the high frequency notes give you a little bit more range than the low frequency notes. Once you do that experiment, you say, gee, how high do I have to go? Okay, you go high enough in frequency, like 1 megacycle, 3.5 megacycles, 14 megacycles, and you use the right kind of a transmitting device, you and I call it a dipole, all of a sudden your range goes from tens of feet into 10,000 kilometers, because that radio signal at that higher frequency, it obeys some very different rules. It bounces off the ionosphere, it propagates into space very well with the right kind of receiver, you get a long range. So once you go up to a high enough frequency, you can transmit a signal. And now if you want to transmit that signal by turning the signal on and off, you and I call it Morse code, and you can send Morse code on the 20-meter band essentially anywhere in the world when the ionosphere is supporting you. So the radio frequency, the so-called carrier frequency, is where the range is coming from. And turning it on and off is one way. And all of a sudden, somebody decided that, gee, turning it on and off is great, and as long as you've got a skilled operator who knows the Morse code, you can send a message. Let me drop. And somewhere around, I guess it was 1910 or so, I don't know the exact year, somebody said, gee, I want to start transmitting audio. So the radio signal, the high frequency, so-called carrier, transmits the basic information that a signal is there. Now you have the choice. You can change the signal abruptly, as we described before, by thoroughly turning it on and off. Well, you can decide to turn it on and off a little bit. Go down to half amplitude and up to twice amplitude. Do that in a sinusoidal manner, and you and I call that amplitude modulation. If you've got the right kind of a frequency discriminator built into the receiver you're using, you don't have to change the amplitude. You can change the frequency. You can wave the frequency up and down with the audio. The basic information is being transmitted on the high-frequency carrier. Once you accept that, you can then decide, am I going to modulate its amplitude or modulate its frequency? Sometimes people call it amplitude modulation or angular modulation. Once you study what's going on with the frequency modulation, with reference to your center frequency, and you're moving the frequency up and down, you could also call it making the phase of the signal you're sending go up and down. That's your choice, whether you use phase or frequency modulation. They're both called angular. So you're taking the basic carrier, and you're changing it in some way to convey the audio. The audio itself ain't going to come within 1% of the range you would like, but that carrier's got the range, and now you have to choose your method of modulating that carrier. And as you go into digital techniques, there's more and more elaborate combinations of amplitude and phase, but the basic amplitude modulation or the basic frequency modulation is taking the thing that gets there and changing it in a way that the receiver can understand, and the demodulator, the detector stage of the receiver, converts that carrier...
repeater, timeout, cancel.
Converts that modulated carrier back into audio. The audio amplifier stage makes it stronger, sends it to a loudspeaker, and you hear the audio coming out of that radio. But it's really the carrier that got it there. Maybe that helps some, John. K2KIF, K2RIW in the tech net.
I have a comment.
John first. Go ahead, John.
Okay. Very good. Very good. And second to that, since we're on the subject, why is it on amplitude modulation, the sound quality of the audio, the high frequencies are cut off? Over to you, K2KIF.
That's only a function of the design of the transmitter and the design of the receiver, John. If I had set up a system that has enough what they call fade margin, in other words, let's assume that my radio gets pretty good reception as long as the signal being received is stronger than 1 microvolt at the antenna port. And I set up a strong enough transmitter, a high enough gain antenna, so that the signal you get is 100 microvolts instead of 1 microvolt. 100 microvolts is 40 decibels stronger. I've got a 40 decibel signal-to-noise ratio going into that radio. And if I design that radio transmitter to transmit 0 to 20 kilohertz, and I design the receiver to design to receive 0 to 20 kilohertz of bandwidth. You'll hear that audio, and you think you're in the room with that orchestra. You think you are there, high fidelity. But there's a catch. The radio receiver, if it's made for broadcast reception, where each of the individual stations are only 10 kilohertz apart, and you want your receiver to receive your fancy, your favorite station and reject the two adjacent stations, you're going to give the receiver limited bandwidth. In order for your transmitter not to create splatter that falls into the bandwidth of the adjacent transmitting stations, you're going to limit the bandwidth there. So for reasons of frequency allocations, FCC rules, and whatever, the design of the typically available radio AM transmitters and radio receivers, that's where the limitation is taking place. On top of that, the signal is bouncing all over the place. You're getting multipath, particularly at nighttime. You're starting to hear signals from long distance away. You're getting co-channel interference. All of these things affect the
repeater, timeout, cancel.
All of those things affect the fidelity of what you hear on AM broadcast. FM broadcast, where the individual stations are 200 kilohertz apart, not 10 kilohertz, and there you are allowed plus or minus 150 kilohertz of FM deviation, you're allowed to transmit audio that goes out to at least 15 kilohertz of bandwidth. So because of the design of the system and the frequencies allocated, and because of the way an FM discriminator works, where it takes weaker signals and almost wipes them out when you've got co-channel interference, you put it all together, and good FM broadcast sounds a lot better. It isn't because of the nature of the modulation. The major difference is because of the design of the equipment and the frequency bandwidth that are available in those frequency ranges when they were first set up. AM came first, and around 1 megacycle is where AM broadcast was set up. FM came later. In the early days, it was running at 48 megacycles. Nowadays, it runs at 88 to 108 megacycles. There's a lot more bandwidth. You've got 20 megacycles of bandwidth up there where FM is required, is allowed, and it's running at VHF frequencies, which tends not to give you anywhere near as much co-channel interference. It doesn't suddenly give you a band opening where you're hearing somebody from Chicago. It's a rare event on FM, whereas to hear Chicago on AM, you'll hear it every night if you know where to listen to it. So it's equipment limitations, not the basic modulation itself. Let me drop one more time. By the same token, an awful lot of people will say, single sideband has got some real good punch. It gets through the noise and the QR Mary. But I don't like the way it sounds. It's not hi-fi. Again, that's an equipment limitation. When you listen to a wireline telephone conversation, and if you study what's really going on, you've got hundreds of telephone conversations coming over one piece of wire or one microwave carrier on your telephone circuits. All of those individual channels of the audio you're listening to are single sideband. And there's a master oscillator somewhere telling the whole system how to properly demodulate that without a frequency error. So properly designed, single sideband can give you all the fidelity you've ever desired. The equipment that's available to you just happens not to have that fidelity because of the speech processor and the limited bandwidth of the IF filters so that you don't hear too much QR Mary and whatever. You're listening to equipment limitations, not process limitations, in my mind. Over to you, John. K2KIF. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Comment? Okay. K2RIW, you satisfied my questions. And I thank you for your comments and expertise on that issue. Over to the other station, K2KIF.
You got it, Wesley.
Yeah, I have a comment on it. At first, you forgot to mention that it is not only ionosphere, but it's a stratosphere to a certain frequency. Actually, it bounces between ionosphere to the stratosphere, and then when it finds a hole, it goes down, so it's randomly available in the certain areas. And the second thing is that at a certain height of the frequency, actually the signal, the ionosphere becomes transparent, so there is no way to bounce it. And I believe this is the perfect timing, actually, to discuss that what I was saying about single siphon. Back to you.
Pretty soon, but let's first find out if Paul is available for our space report. WS2N, are you available? K2RAW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. Yes, I have been listening all night. How you doing? You mentioned Voyager before. Something happened with Voyager?
Absolutely. I am looking at Sunday New York Times. Let's see, what's the date on the Dawn thing? Sunday, August 29th, of today's date, in the book section on page 21, is a beautiful book being advertised called Voyager by Stephen Payne. And it's a full-page description of what Voyager is like. Voyager spacecraft was launched in August 20, 1977. Voyager number 2 was launched before Voyager number 1. And then September 5th, Voyager number 1 was launched. So in 1977, which is what? 43 years ago, the spacecraft flew by Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Venus, Uranus, Neptune. It did a great big grand flyby. It got gravity assist from each one of those planets. Voyager is now a little bit shy of 10 billion miles away. 3.6 billion miles is the distance to Pluto. The two Voyager spacecraft are almost three times the distance to Pluto. I'm guessing it's something like 20 hours of round-trip communication time at the speed of light. Let me drop. To my knowledge, NASA is still communicating with Voyager at 10 billion miles. When Voyager was launched, it was using a traveling wave tube transmitter at a X-band frequency, which had approximately 10 watts of output running on a nuclear power supply. By now, that traveling wave tube is probably down to 5 watts. A 5-watt QRP transmitter, 10 billion miles away, is still communicating with NASA. It's approaching the threshold where it's about to leave the confines of what you and I call the sun's solar system, and yet we're still communicating with it. And the reason we're communicating with it is because NASA was smart enough to design that system where you can tell the Voyager spacecraft, hey, the signal's getting kind of weak, I'm getting pretty high error on the digital information you're sending me, the pictures and data you're sending me, so please send the data a little bit slower. And I think they're now down to, I don't know the exact number, but it's probably 5 bits per second, or something like that. So that when you use the right kind of a phase lock loop receiver on the Goldstone dish to listen to that, and you narrow up the receiver so that it has 5 hertz of bandwidth, all of a sudden you can listen to a signal a hell of a lot weaker as the signal goes further and further away. Yes, that limits your data rate, but they can still talk to it at a ridiculous range. That is the furthest piece of hardware, to my knowledge, that mankind has ever launched, and it's three times the distance of Pluto. And we're still talking to it and still getting data, and both of them are still talking, to my knowledge. That's one piece of space information, of course, I tell you about, and a little bit later I'll tell you about what Kepler is doing, because that was in Newsday, page 38, and which issue was this of Newsday? Friday's issue, August 27, a beautiful article about what... A beautiful article about what Kepler is doing. Kepler has already discovered 700 exoplanet candidates in the first 43 days of operation, the first month and a half, and it's been in operation for 7 months. They've only processed the first month and a half of data, and they've already found 700 planets, as well as finding, they found three double planets already. But there's a couple of catches there. But I'll pass it back to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I wanted to see the news conference that they were going to have about Kepler last week, but I wasn't home for that. I would have brought it up on NASA TV. They always have the news conferences on that. But I missed it. So, they were going to make this a big announcement, and they mentioned that a day or two before, that they were going to have the information. So that's probably it. The 700 some odd planets that they already found with Kepler. Very good. I remember, a year or two ago, reading that Voyager was being transmitted to and from 160 bits per second, Dick. So I think it's a little above five, unless it dropped off dramatically in the last year or two. We drop it. Apparently there's a new book out regarding that topic. You said 40-some-odd years. I think it's 33 years that it's been up there. And 20 years ago, about a little over 20 years ago, it passed the orbit of Neptune. Both of them did, Voyager 1 and 2. Voyager 1, they really wanted to get a view of Titan going around Saturn. They wanted to try to see what some of those clouds. Of course, we know now that there is methane on Titan. But we wanted to look at the moon going around Saturn. But to do that, they needed to change the trajectory of one of the spacecraft. They chose Voyager 1. And if you look at a diagram of the solar system, you know, you have the ecliptic plane. All the planets are pretty much going around like a disc, you know, like a LP or a CD, going around and together in uniform, except for Pluto. Pluto's got the ecliptic is off on that a little bit. Let me drop it. Well, if you look at a model of where Voyager is, Voyager 1 and 2, 1 is going pretty much like north of the ecliptic, you know, where Voyager 2 isn't. They sent Voyager 2 beyond Saturn and passing Neptune. And back in 1989 area, as they both passed that, that was, 20 years ago. 20 years ago, passed the last planet. Of course, Pluto was the planet at the time, but around that time, Pluto was also crossing the same distance as Neptune. Every now and then, Pluto will do that. Growing up, Pluto was always the furthest planet, and then at some point there, Neptune actually became further away from the sun than Pluto did. So, but it doesn't matter anyway. Pluto is no longer a planet. So yeah, these spacecraft are on their way. Let me drop it. You talked about the plutonium on board the spacecraft. They have done that on quite a few spacecraft, Voyager including, and they have enough power and fuel. There is fuel still on board both spacecraft to last until the year 2020. So we could be talking about this 10 years from now, Dick, as this thing goes through the heliopause and eventually out to, it's already, you know, it's already past the Kuiper belt. And where does the solar system end? Well, it ends out by, I consider the end is the Oort cloud. And the Oort cloud goes maybe one-third of the way to the next nearest star. The next nearest star is 4.5 light years away. Proxima Centauri. Well, I used to call it Alpha Centauri, but now for some reason Proxima Centauri is now the closest. So it's got a long way to go to really leave the influence of the solar system. To give you an idea, if you wait around 300,000 years from now, these things are going, about 39, 40,000 miles per hour away from the sun. Let me drop it. They've been going, 33 years. If you wait 300,000 years from now, you know, not 30,000, not 3,000, but 300,000 years from now, it will pass the star Sirius. Sirius, which is the brightest star in our sky. It will pass that star. It'll pass it around within four and a half light years of that star. Well, 4.5 light years. Wow, it sounds like it's pretty close. Sirius is almost nine light years from Earth. So, to give you an idea of 300,000 years from now, it'll be, well, closer to Sirius than it is us, but about halfway. So, the solar system is a very big place. If you go from one end of the solar system to the other, I think it's something like 100,000 light years. So, from one end of the galaxy to the other. And 100,000 light years. And here's Sirius, 8 light years away. And this thing taking 300,000 years to get halfway to Sirius. Amazing thing. Back to your WS2.
You gotta think big. I think they're slowly discovering the center of every galaxy has got a number of black holes holding it all together. I think the Milky Way galaxy, the one we're in, I've heard various numbers, but in the early days I heard numbers like 150,000 light years diameter. And ours is just an average size galaxy in sort of an average position in the universe. We're a member of something like 4 local galaxies in our local galactic group, our cluster, and there's 10 to the 11 power observable galaxies. And when you use that ultra-deep field photograph that was done by the Hubble Space Telescope a few years ago, it just looked into a dark area of the universe that had never been really photographed before, took a 1 million second picture, a nice time exposure, and saw 2,300 galaxies that have never been seen before, and each galaxy has got 100 billion stars. A lot of stuff out there. And great big distances. The numbers are just out of sight. Yeah, the Kepler telescope is the one that's being used now, the Kepler space probe, to discover how many exoplanets are there in our neighborhood. Let me drop. Ever since roughly 1995, when we discovered the very first planet going around a star, our method of detection has been the Doppler wobble technique, as I'm going to call it, where you take the individual fine lines of emission coming out of the glowing gas of a sun. You know, you got a hydrogen line and an iron line and an oxygen line and so on. You look at those lines with very high resolution, and you'll notice that the lines very slowly advance to the right and advance to the left in frequency, up and down, because the star is being wobbled by the mass of the planets going around it. Use that technique, and you can discover Jupiter-sized planets that are in close, because they really tug on the star and they wobble it. And they're now up to something like 300 stars have been discovered with planets by that method. But the trouble with that method is it only finds the big, heavy things that are in close. The Earth-sized planets out at our distance essentially cannot be discovered by that technique. The technique is not sensitive enough. So you set up this Kepler telescope, which is staring in one particular direction of the sky, and it's looking at 2 or 3 lunar diameters left and right and up and down. It's looking at something like 150,000 stars all at once. And it's very carefully measuring the light output of each one of those stars. And when a planet that goes around that star passes in front of the star, let me drop, you get a very small dip in the light that you're seeing from that star. By looking at the shape of the dip and the duration of the dip, you rapidly find out how big is the planet, how close it is to the star, and how big is the star, and so on. You find out a lot of information. And so that Kepler project has been in operation now for 7 months, and they've done a moderate amount of processing of the first month and a half of data, and they have found 700 planets already, 700 candidate planets. They call it a candidate planet until a Earth-based observatory is given the exact coordinates and does a confirmation by the usual techniques. And so the good news is we're discovering a whole lot of planets. Almost all those stars have planets is one possible guess. However, so far the data is showing a large number of massive planets in close. and they've seen very few Earth-sized planets at an Earth-sized distance. So maybe we're going to discover that an Earth-type, a Goldilocks location of an Earth-sized planet is a little bit on the rare side, in which case we're a little more alone than we thought. But that's too early to tell from the data. But a big QSO in the sky is going to take a little while. So what else is NASA doing these days, Paul? And is those ammonium coolers on the International Space Station perking along very nicely now? WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, they're doing very, very good. Last I heard, everything was up and running. About, you know, full operation within a couple of few days after that last spacewalk. That was supposed to be done in two spacewalks. They did it in three. They had problems with the first one, disconnecting that. And when I think about disconnecting these inch and a half diameter lines in space, supposedly quick disconnect, you got to push this button and this lever and pull this connection apart from each valve, four of them to do that, each one that had contained ammonia, trying to disconnect these things in, well, either 250 degree or 250 minus degree temperatures. It's unbelievable. They're working inside a spacesuit, blowing up with 5 pounds per square inch, kind of like working inside of a football, and try to move with your hands and maneuver these valves, and push a button. When I think of the, you know, it's done 1, 2, 3 on Earth, or even on the Moon. We're floating around in space. One guy that's trying to do it is attached to a robotic arm. Let me drop it. I don't think they get enough credit. You don't see many news reports dealing with that. I've seen a couple, but that's some test. And then to reconnect them all after everything's done. You know, and in the meantime, you've got to disconnect 5 of these electrical lines. You've got to disconnect the hand grappling fixture. You've got to disconnect 4 bolts. And it's quite a project. And then before all this, they've got to pump the ammonia out of it. You know, and it's all liquid. It's not a true air conditioning system what we think. There's no evaporators, no condensers. There's nothing evaporating and nothing condensing inside this ammonia system. Ammonia is a very good refrigerant, by the way. It carries about half the amount of BTUs that water could carry. But it's not used like that. It's only used because it doesn't freeze that easy. Let me drop it. It freezes something like around minus 167. But the temperatures go down to minus 250. It won't freeze in the lines because they're continually being pumped. And there's constant heat that's coming out of the International Space Station with all the electronics going on. And, basically, that's where most of the heat is coming from. You're in a closed area. It would be like closing up your house 100% and having all the wiring and everything eventually creating heat and building up inside the house. That's what it's like inside the International Space Station. It doesn't go through the walls and just like blow it out. You know, it's there's no way to get rid of the heat. So they use these heat exchangers inside, running water through the heat exchangers to the ammonia side, and you know, with inside the space station. They're actually in the nodes, a couple of the nodes between the interconnecting units, and that's where these heat exchangers are. Let me drop it. And then the ammonia is from those heat exchangers are pumped, and the pumps are outside and pumped through these gigantic panels outside,
and that's how they get rid of the heat. And there's no compressors, you know, compressing like a Freon compressing a gas and condensing it with a condenser outside to cool it, and having a TX or a thermostatic expansion valve inside with an evaporator and expanding and sucking up the heat inside. Nothing like that is going on. It's all fluids. So that's why they have these big inch and a half lines outside. And there's one on the starboard side, one on the port side. The starboard side is the one that failed. So that all went well. When I think of the work that they did, the engineering that went on to figure out how to go about doing this, it's pretty remarkable. I mean, they weren't made to change out. Let's put it that way. They weren't definitely made to change out. Let me drop it. But the crews on board never were tested on this. They were never in a buoyancy tank down in Alabama floating around doing this. This is the first time that a crew that was floating in space got a call up that they had to do this. And they had people doing it on Earth, and then they would tell the astronauts how they went about doing it. But usually, you know, something like this has to be done, like the Hubble repair mission. You know, you have a crew down here on Earth maybe for over a year in a buoyancy tank duplicating what they're going to do when they get to the Hubble, and then they go up and do it. These guys are up there. They never planned on changing this ammonia tank out. And all went well. So the first time they got involved with something like that, as I remember, Dick. That's the story in the ammonia tanks, the ammonia pumps. Let me put it that way. The pumps, the tanks are actually located near the pumps. They weren't changed. Back to you, Dick. WS-20.
You've once told me, and I've forgotten, Paul, is there an approximate number of volts and amps or watts that we can estimate is coming from the solar panel? They've got a massive solar panel. Dave into APG told me this week twice. One of them was on Friday night, I think, where the International Space Station passed almost straight overhead of Long Island. And I went out and looked at it, and it was bright, a -3 magnitude. So I think the majority of what that reflection is coming from is those solar panels. But if we knew the total number of watts, I'm going to pick a number. Maybe it's 100 kilowatts of power coming from those solar panels. All of that power is being pumped into the International Space Station. A little bit of it can be going into charging batteries, and there you're doing a chemical reaction. The rest of it is running some kind of machinery, and all of that machinery, the final output, other than a little bit of display on the screen or a little bit of a change of some experiment, is heat. So if the solar panels are giving you 100 kilowatts of power into the International Space Station, you could say that inside that space station, you are generating 100 kilowatts of heat. That's a lot. And it's got to be done. A conservation of energy. If you're pumping energy in, it's got to go somewhere. It's turning into heat. So do you happen to know the approximate number of watts, kilowatts, or whatever that those solar panels are giving the International Space Station? WS2N, KQRIW, and the TechNav.
Government.
Paul first. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, I'm trying to think. 30 kilowatts per solar section, and there's four solar sections. So that would be in that ballpark, I would think. These things are 240 feet long, each one. 40 feet wide, there's two per set, and there's four sets. So they're huge things. There are big motors on these things, turning them. So some of the energy is being used to turn them. Some of the energy is being used to turn these ammonia panels. They rotate back and forth because of the they want to keep them edgewise into the sun so they don't heat up. They're trying to get rid of the heat. Solar panels, they're trying to keep pointing to the sun. And a lot of batteries are on the they call it the Zarya, or the functioning cargo block, the first part of the space station that was put up there by the Russians. So big, huge batteries in that compartment, constantly being recharged, and that's inside the space station under the flooring. There are batteries outside on the, I think, the Z1 structure, big batteries, so that would be on the outside of the space station, dropping. But, but they're running a lot of tests, heaters and things like that inside all the different modules, inside the Columbus module by the European Space Agency, gigantic room up there that they're working on. That was one of the rooms that they had to cut back testing a little bit to offset the heat load because of the loss of the ammonia system. Also in the Kaibo unit, which is right near the Columbus unit, that's that gigantic. That's the biggest room going. That's by Japan. Actually, there's two rooms involved, two sections that were put up there by the space shuttle over the last few years. So that there were some tests that were cut back in that area. Rest of the station is Destiny, which is the main lab for the United States, was no problem there. And the Russian module was fine too. But they're all running tests and everything's up. And I don't know. There's got to be 100 computers on board the space station. It's unbelievable. If you ever go and put a space tour on a computer, they're all over. So power, everything. Everything's running off of the panels. Drop it. The only time they could get rid of some extra power being generated by the panels is when the space shuttle docks. And unfortunately, with only two more missions left, that's not going to happen. The last half a dozen missions, they've docked to the space station and recharged the space shuttle to some degree. They have so much power up there. And they are able to have extended missions. Instead of your typical 12, 13 days, they were all running like, 15, 16, 17 days, no problem. So, what are we going to do with all this power, Dick? Back to you.
Quick comment, Dick.
John recognized, and you're going to be right after Wesley. I just did a quick calculation. You said 30 kilowatts per panel, and there's four panels. That's 120 kilowatts total. That's 120 kilowatts. If all of that was converted into heat, would be 409,000 BTU. My house has a furnace that's around 100,000 BTU, so I could heat four of my houses. My house is 60 feet long, 30 feet wide, and easily that 100,000 BTU heater can easily heat my medium insulated house on a minus 10 degree day. So I can overcome 80 degrees Fahrenheit of temperature difference with 100,000 BTUs. That International Space Station, I think, has less volume than my house, and it's got four times the heating capability just being caused by the amount of electrical power being applied to it. 120,000 kilowatts is around 409,000 BTUs. That's a lot of heat. And I think the majority of that energy is going into heat. Maybe Wesley feels differently. We're about to find out. Into XJM, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, actually, that's what I wanted to comment on. It was very precisely described. I have nothing to add. Back to you.
I'm sorry. I apparently took the wind out of your sail. Let's see what John's got to say. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
I don't know, Paul. It sounds like Dick's going to be screwing those solar panels to his tower out there. Dick, I just wanted to remind Paul. I spoke to him on Monday. He did a little more research on the Dawn mission. Maybe he would like to fill you in on those questions you had last week.
Go right ahead, Paul.
Oh, thanks, John. I forgot about the Dawn topic. We had a few questions that went unanswered last week. They have the ion engines, but there's three ion engines on board the Dawn spacecraft. And they do actuate. They can move them. They can move them in the different axes to push the craft one way or the other. the three ion engines are not on at the same time. They'll run one, and then one more, the other one will shut off, that type of thing. They'll cycle them.